So this is the third talk of the first week, and I'm going to talk about the Mahayana path in two sections. I mentioned in the prior talk that there's often an earthy quality in the sutras of the foundational Buddhism, where the Buddha is talking with specific individuals and you have a sense of the suffering or the difficulty the people are encountering and how the Buddha is trying to help them. In the Mahayana, the sutras often have this vast, almost cosmic level of description that doesn't have that immediate sense of earthy human directness. It's considered to have great profundity to it, but nonetheless, it can be a little daunting in the sort of majestic vastness of the Mahayana sutras. The Mahayana vow itself is this inconceivable undertaking that you vow to help all beings attain a Buddhahood. This is not only understood to encompass all beings, you know, insects and everything that flies and swims and all the animals that roam the earth, which is an inconceivable number of beings. And it's said also that even your own Buddhahood, the attainment of Buddhahood, will take three incalculable eons just for yourself, let alone then proceeding to help all these other beings. So it seems just impossible, inconceivable to be able to do this. So in discussing the Bodhisattva path, I thought it'd be helpful to comment in a more earthy level of discussion about how one might conceive of taking such a vow. And then in the second section of the talk, talk about the classic description of the path, the traditional way it's described. So it'll be very different in the second half. So to understand the sort of pragmatic way in which one could actually connect to this aspiration of attaining enlightenment for the purpose of helping all other beings attain enlightenment, it's very helpful to look at the roots of the Mahayana in foundational Buddhism. In foundational Buddhism, the core teaching is the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path to the cessation of suffering. And the encouragement in that tradition is to actually face up to the amount of suffering that is occurring. So there's the question of how do we work with our experience? How do we work with suffering? And I'd like to share a teaching from foundational Buddhism that I think is particularly profound, and it's not widely known. It occurs in the Abhidharma Kosha of Vasubandhu, the Vaibhashika Abhidharma, and it's the teaching of the three principal causes for the arising of an affliction, for the arising of a klesha. So why do we experience kleshas? So the tradition says there are three main causes for this. One, we have habitual propensities, latent propensities for certain patterns. We as individuals differ as to what afflicted mental states we tend to have. So, you know, one person tends to be self-deprecating and lonely. Another person is very angry, aggressive. Another person can be frequently proud and arrogant, jealousy, and so forth. There's a range of emotions that we as individuals can have, and we tend to play certain keys on the keyboard of the emotions more than others, and we develop habitual patterns. So these habitual patterns are understood to be present all the time, but they're not firing all the time. So the mere presence of a habitual pattern isn't sufficient to understand why we have an actual painful episode. A second condition is called the observed object condition, and the objects that trigger us vary significantly. So think of what in your life triggers your afflicted mental states. You could take out a piece of paper and write a little list, maybe not so little, of what does that to you, what triggers you. Now, if you were to compare that, you have five people compare lists, there would be a wide range of objects. And if you knew the same people, worked at the same place, you wouldn't necessarily be triggered by the same things. So there's an interesting feature here that a given object does not have the same effect on all people. So there are observable characteristics, but is the desirability or adverseness of those objects intrinsic to the object? If different people react very differently to the same object, if you really are irritated at someone else, but for another person, they're their best friend, right? Is this, are these qualities intrinsic to the person? So the implication here is, while objects have observable features, you know, for example, when you look at people, we see all sorts of things that we impute, what their sexual orientation is, what their economic status is, what their political values are. You know, if you see a person dressed a certain way, you know, they're in a hemp T-shirt with marijuana on it, you're going to be less likely to impute, you know, one political party over another and so forth and so on. We do all sorts of imputations and interpretations all the time, and we have emotional reactions to those interpretations. And so from this point of view, the object is has observable qualities, but the emotional reactions that we have to them are not intrinsic to the object. If they were, would not everybody have the same reaction to the object? So even the same object doesn't produce the same reaction. So the third factor is the crucial one. It's called improper mental engagement. That if you generate anger towards an object, it's your mind doing that. We talked in an earlier talk about how all beings are worthy of compassion, and that if you have an afflicted mental reaction to a person, you are very actively a participant in creating that emotion, that it's not an intrinsic automatic reaction to the person. They may be doing lots of negative activities, but the suggestion here is that is not an actual cause of your affliction. It's the way you interpret that, the way you react to it, that instead of feeling compassion and sympathy, you generate all sorts of other possible negative emotions. So this is a foundational Buddhist teaching that indicates that we have a tremendous amount of responsibility for the types of reactions we have to people. Now, they can be very deeply ingrained. It can be very, very hard to experience them as something that we're creating. But from the tradition's point of view, you can undo that over time. You can slowly undo the improper mental engagement. And then when you experience a difficult person, you can just experience the qualities directly without interpreting them negatively and then feel compassion for it. Okay. Now, the Mahayana takes this type of insight. This is, again, a foundational Buddhist teaching. It has tremendous insight in it. But the Mahayana would take it further, and it's teaching on emptiness, that all these projections, there's a real strong flavor in Mahayana tradition of seeing the illusion-like quality of the way you experience the world. The interpretive stance you take, that you project all these qualities and interpretations, that you realize that those are your projections, that they are created by the mind, they're imputed, but they have just the shimmering ephemeral existence, that they're there as long as you produce them. And furthermore, you train more and more in not solidifying the other as this dualistic solid object over there, that they're this vividly arising process in front of you that is often confused and acting in a very harmful way, but you don't interpret that as they're just intrinsically evil. There's this much more fluid, open sense of sympathy towards this process. So as you progress along in working with difficulties, both in your own mind and in others, you develop insight. You know that you understand something. And once you begin to see that about yourself, like if you see that you project a lot of qualities and you believe them, once you begin to catch on that we do that, it's hard to undo that insight. You begin to realize, you know, I'm understanding something here. This is something that I really have experienced for myself and know this to be the case, that I have a lot of responsibility in creating that. So when you have that type of insight, there's a certain confidence that that is the case. You know that. It's like asking someone, do you know the flavor of an orange? And they say, yes, I love oranges. And oranges are amazingly vivid. And I know what an orange tastes like. It has that quality that I know what it's like to disarm, to stop demonizing the other person. And that the experience of my mind, it softens. There's a sense of kindness to myself and towards them. I've experienced that. I've tasted that myself. And so there's this sense of growing confidence. However, life is quite complex and demanding. So it's not like I'm this hyper confident, I know everything, I can handle anything. It's not like that at all. It's much messier than that. But within that uncertainty that you don't know if you can handle things, there is still this growing trust in yourself that you have this capacity for insight, you have this capacity for kindness, for compassion, for patience, for exerting yourself in the face of real fear. You could have a fear of being able to handle a difficult person. So it's a messy path. The Mahayana path is quite messy, but there's this growing trust in yourself that you do have these positive qualities. There's a phrase from a current master in the Tibetan tradition, Kinpo Tsuchim Gyamsa Rinpoche. He's getting quite elderly now, but he has a phrase, erring and erring, I walk the unerring path. Erring meaning to go astray, to go off, to be harmful, you know, to do something non-virtuous, to be harsh on yourself and to then inflict that on others. And that, again, his statement is, erring and erring, I proceed along the unerring path. That is to say that we learn from this process. This is how we learn. We have insights from our confusion, insights from our negative actions, insights from the harmful actions of others. So oddly enough, or paradoxically, you become interested. You're drawn to understanding difficult people, difficult situations, instead of being fearful of it and put off. There still can be a sense of you're not sure you can handle it, that you can understand it. But there's this sort of turning allegiance to your own capacities for insight and compassion. And you can't stop that. Once you start having that sort of insight, it will unfold. And therefore, you don't really have a choice. It's like choiceless awareness is one word that's been used for this, that you can't stop it. And therefore, it's your heart's desire. It's your greatest, you have this sort of fascination about really pursuing this type of path of developing these qualities of insight and compassion. So it's not like you feel like, you know, you've won, you know, 5 gold Olympics medals already, and I'm ready for it, and I'm going to go earn 3 more, where you have this tremendous supposed confidence, right? It's not like that. It's much more hesitant, uncertain, messy, but nonetheless, there is this sort of real trust, and you have this one phrase sometimes used, basic goodness, or the term Buddha nature applies here, that you have this seeds, this capacity to be enlightened. And so this is more the quality of the Mahayana path, when you take the Bodhisattva vow, that you know what you've seen, you know what you've understood, you know how you've developed in a very skillful way to this point. It's been a messy process, but you feel inspired. And so the teacher will offer a Bodhisattva vow. There'll be a public ceremony. And that's an important part where you publicly make this statement that I vow from this day forward to act to help all sentient beings attain enlightenment. And it's a very personal matter, but it's also a public thing. And the teacher has the trust and confidence in you that you can do it. And is encouraging you to do this, but you have to decide to do it. It's your own motivation. Now I'd like to shift to the second part of the talk, which is the discussion of the classic way in which the Mahayana path is described. So we're more at the vast, majestic quality of the Mahayana teachings. In general, if you were to ask, what is the Buddhist path? What does it consist of? There's 2 classic ways that is described, and they both sort of equate to each other, and they occur in foundational Buddhism as well as in Mahayana Buddhism. The first way of describing this is the 3 trainings. This is Sila, Samadhi, and Pragna. Sila is conduct, engaging in your daily life in an ethical way that transforms yourself. Samadhi is meditation. Meditation works with your mind, with your patterns, helps you to relax those patterns, to have insight into those patterns, and discover a sense of well-being, of just the sheer simplicity of being present, right? So there's these two aspects to meditation. On one hand, it's this immaculate mirror that reflects your mental state and allows you to have insight into it. And a meditation also sort of reveals this quality of just the sheer simplicity and the sense of well-being of being present. And then the third component is prajna, insight or knowledge. And insight includes a range of things. It's often described in terms of the three prajnas, the three insights or the three knowledges. These are hearing, contemplating, and meditating. These occur, again, in foundational Buddhism as well as in the Mahayana. This is not a particularly, this is a pan-Buddhist teaching. And so prajna, we tend to, in the Mahayana, there's this emphasis on the profound insight that comes from prajna. Prajna is sort of this, it's like virtually the enlightenment of a Buddha, this sense of understanding the ultimate truth, suchness. This is sort of these big terms that are used for prajna. But prajna is an omnipresent mental factor. It's present, it's said to be present in every moment of mind, that the most deluded being has prajna going on. It knows things, even in deluded knowing, that's a type of knowing. So prajna has this vast range. And in terms of the path, it's said that you start with hearing. Hearing is the learning of the teachings. It involves conceptuality. You're listening to someone teach. And then the second phase is a contemplation, where you ponder what's been taught. You investigate it. You probe it. You compare it to your experience. You check it out to see if it makes sense. So there's a process of engaging with the teachings that you've heard in a more personal manner to see if it makes sense. In the Buddhist tradition, there is a discussion of the quality of faith, you know, having faith. But one way to understand that is it's best to actually understand the teachings yourself, to personally understand it. So it's from that point of view, just blind faith is not considered all that useful. And so you're encouraged to probe it, investigate it, to connect it to your experience and see if it makes sense to you. And if it doesn't make sense to you, you should be honest to that you don't understand it, you don't agree with it. You know that the Buddhist teaching of selflessness is pretty tall order, right? That there is no self in here. There is definitely stuff happening here, but there is no core in there. This is very tough for people, right? So the general view is you really need to understand it directly, personally for yourself, for it to really benefit you. So based on this, the second prajna of contemplation, of coming to understand something for yourself, the third level of prajna is meditation. And here by meditation, they mean that you fully embody this insight. It's deeply a part of you, that you've really worked to transform those patterns so that when you find yourself in a difficult situation, what comes out of you is this compassion. You sort of have worked at a deeper level that becomes what your primary motivation that responds to difficult situations. So there's this understanding that it becomes non-conceptual. It's you embody it. You are the teachings. You don't just accept the teachings, think about the teachings, agree with them conceptually, but your mode of being has been transformed so that you embody the actual understanding, so that it just comes out of you effortlessly. So prajna is understood to go through this progression, that at first you hear teachings that are very foreign, that are very distressing, that like, what do you mean there's no chair here? I spent, you know, $200 for this chair. There better well be a chair here. And no, it's just a bunch of parts. There's no chair there. You know, at first you can have these rejecting of, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't. So you have to investigate it, chew on it, think about it, ponder it. And then eventually, if it makes sense to you, it becomes very deeply a part of who you are as a being. And so prajna, the highest prajna, is considered to be non-conceptual. But it doesn't mean that conceptuality is some sort of enemy, that you reject conceptuality. So the Buddhist tradition has this vast ocean of texts and ways of teaching. So conceptuality is never its referent object. The term, you know, strawberry is not a strawberry. That's a deep Buddhist view that language is limited. It is just intrinsically limited, but still helpful. So this is the basic understanding of the Buddhist path, you have the three trainings of Sila, Samadhi, and Prajna, engaging in conduct in your life to develop skillful ethical conduct, engaging in meditation to transform your mind, to have insight into your mind, and developing prajna to the point where you not only understand it, but it's what comes out of you in your engagement with the world. Now, the other way of describing the path is the Eightfold Noble Path. This is very widely known. I won't go through the details here. Again, this occurs in Foundational Buddhism and in the Mahayana, and they correlate with the three trainings. The first two is prajna, the next three is conduct, and the last three are meditation. So the Eightfold Noble Path and the three trainings are interrelated with each other and are saying very similar things. The Eightfold Path just lays out more details. Now to turn to the more distinctive Mahayana approach to the path, and this particular approach is comes from the second turning of the wheel of Dharma from the Madhyamaka school, the middle way school, and it, although it shares many elements with the Yogacara and Chittamatra third turning wheel, the this consists of describing the journey from the point of view of ground, path, and fruition. This is a triad that one sees commonly in Buddhism. The ground of the path is considered to be the two truths, the relative truth and the ultimate truth. Okay. There are many ways of describing the two truths, and we'll talk more about this as the course proceeds, but the relative truth concerns with where we experience samsara occurs here. It relates to appearances, all the relative experiences that we have in our world. And the ultimate truth refers to, it's often described as emptiness. In other words, the unfindability of any solidity within the process of appearance. But it's also described as suchness, or freedom from elaboration is another classic word. And that means that we create an illusory world, a way of relating to appearances that produces all sorts of dualistic polarities and struggles and solidifications. All, you know, we've discussed this process a little bit, so that the afflicted mental states dance on the ground of duality. Okay, so proliferations is this process by which you create an illusory world that's so real to you, and that you then react with not only emotions, but you actually act on your projections. You hit the person. You steal from them. You lie about them. You do things, you actually do things based on your belief in this solidified world that you've produced. So freedom from elaboration is a description of the ultimate truth, that if you don't do that, whatever's left, whatever's there after that is, you stop doing that, is the ultimate. Now, I'll speak briefly from the Kagyu tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. They have a preference in this tradition for the freedom from elaboration as a description of the ultimate rather than emptiness. They will use the term emptiness. But it tends to be one-sided, if you will. It's in Madhyamaka in general, the second turning teachings in general, feels that most people lean of the two extremes, nihilism and eternalism, we tend to lean to the eternalist side. We cling to things as real, we're really solidly real in here, we have a world, a solidified world that we have lots of thoughts and emotions about. We tend to cling to things as real. So Madhyamaka tends to emphasize emptiness rather than appearance. But again, the Mahayana is about the union of appearance and emptiness, the union of compassion and emptiness, the union of dependent origination, the process of appearance and emptiness. So the use of the language of freedom from elaboration can point to this more dynamic, less negative style of language, like the emptiness style. Has more sense of the union of appearance and emptiness, that whatever the mind experiences once you've stopped that solidification process, that it is empty of solidification, but it's not just a nihilistic vacuum. So you might think that one truth is superior to the other. If you ask which is the more important truth, well, naturally you're going to say the ultimate truth. Well, the tradition says no, that can't be the case, because the relative truth is the stairway to realizing the ultimate truth. There's no other way to do it. And therefore, it's considered a major obstacle to reject relative truth, that it's the basis upon which one can learn about the relative truth. You use the relative truth. It's like you use the falling to write yourself up, that you... If you're dealing with someone who has intense emotions and they're projecting all sorts of negative, they're paranoid, they're blaming everybody, and you're looking at them and saying, you really are misunderstanding. These people are trying to help you, and you deeply don't understand it. You have to work with their state of mind as it is. You have to deal with what their thoughts are, what their emotions are, and you have to use that to try to engender insight. And eventually, they can discover this experience, how it's fabricated. They're creating this world that they seem so real to them. But you can't just say, it's all empty, get over it. And beyond that, it's not said all the time, frequently, but occasionally you'll hear statements like the union of the two truths, right? This is the Heart Sutra. If you've ever read the Heart Sutra, many, many people have. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form, emptiness is no other than form, form is no other than emptiness, right? There's this type of talking in the Mahayana tradition about the union of appearance and emptiness, the union of relative truth and ultimate truth. That there's this natural purity. Again, we talked about in a prior talk about, from the Mahayana point of view, the inseparability of samsara and nibbana, the natural purity of samsara, that all of the negative qualities that we create within samsara actually have no root and can be transformed into a luminous, compassionate state. So the true truths is the ground. So understanding these various qualities and elements that we've been talking about is the ground for proceeding on the path. And then the path itself is described as the two accumulations, the accumulation of merit and the accumulation of wisdom. So this is the more applied, you might say, that you're grappling with your life from the point of view of trying to figure out how to understand it from the wisdom side of its, you know, transparency, its luminosity, its openness, its the creative possibility of really transforming how you engage in it, that involves insight into the emptiness of it all. And then the accumulation of merit, of learning to engage in a way that produces well-being. So the two accumulations are the path. So you have wisdom and merit. And then the fruition is described as the two kayas, the two bodies. And this correlates to a previous talk, that when a Buddha enters into nirvana, parinirvana, that they still manifest to help the world. It's not a one-sided nirvana, it's a non-abiding nirvana. They're not rejecting samsara. They still are motivated spontaneously to manifest to aid beings. So it's said the two kayas are the dharmakaya and the rupakaya. The dharmakaya is this sort of profound suchness level, the ultimate truth level, which is the experience, the personal experience, if you will, personal, of the Buddha, that there's no solidification. You could describe it as luminous as well as empty. It's considered to have just limitless qualities of compassion and skillful means and patience and all these insights and so forth. And then the rupakaya means the body, but rupa means body or form, and it's how the Buddha then manifests out. The rupakaya is divided into two kayas, so you end up with three kayas. This is the more common teaching in Mahayana, that the Buddha manifests two levels. There's a subtle level that the Buddha manifests for high-level bodhisattvas. There's a sort of communication among a really evolved people, and then that's called the sambhogakaya, the enjoyment kaya. And then the third one is nirmanakaya, the emanation body, which ordinary beings are said to experience. So that we as ordinary deluded beings can interact with the Buddha at the level of the nirmanakaya. So, So it said, this spontaneously occurs. The Buddha has accumulated the aspiration to help beings for eons, has developed skillful means, and just automatically manifests compassionately to help beings. So in summary, then, you have the ground as the two truths, the relative truth and the ultimate truth. The path is the two accumulations, the accumulation of merit and accumulation of wisdom. And the accumulation of merit corresponds to the relative truth level, and the accumulation of wisdom corresponds to the ultimate truth level. And then the result is the two kayas, the two bodies, the dharmakaya, or let me flip it, the rupakaya, which is the manifestation of the Buddha, which corresponds to accumulation of merit and relative truth. And the dharmakaya is the profound realization of the Buddha, the inner experience that realizes the ultimate truth and the wisdom aspect of the path. So.